From the studios of WEKU on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University, this is Eastern Standard. Hello, I'm John Hingsbergen. Since the summer of 2013, we've been here every week with discussions of important issues, interviews with interesting people, and coverage of major news stories, including our annual visits to Frankfurt during the legislative sessions. This week, during our fund drive, it's a special edition of our program, and we're calling it Voices of NPR, featuring four folks that you've gotten to know over the years, three of them providers of news, one of them providing entertainment, ironically, that entertainment based on the news. Jean Cochran brought us news in the mornings for many years during a morning edition during her 33 years at NPR before retiring in December of 2013. Just a few months after her retirement, she was our guest for the first ever WEKU Day Sponsor reception. That was the year we decided to record an edition of this show at the annual Day Sponsor event, and we've continued to do so every year since. Stay with us for more information about this year's event featuring NPR political commentator Cokie Roberts. But let's get this show started with Jean Cochran from May of 2014. We begin with Jean telling us about her choice to get into broadcast journalism.
I was about 22 years old, and I, just to keep it, I knew I wanted to get into communications. This was the era of Mary Tyler Moore. I wanted to do that. I wanted to work in broadcasting somehow, some way. And from there, I sort of decided news would be a contribution to society. Here I am, about 22 years old. Okay, news, now what? Television, print, or radio? Television gets in the way of sources. Television has too many, you know, microphones, I mean, cameramen, lightmen, at least at that time, even a field producer maybe. That gets in the way of a story. Print, you're just a pad and pencil. It's pretty pure, but you have to spell people's names right and get their middle initials. This was too much level of detail for me at that time. I thought radio was just right because you could break in with a breaking news story without getting, you know, television was too cumbersome to break into a soap opera. It took a while. So I thought the immediacy of radio, I did not want looks to be a factor in my career. So I ruled out television. You age better on radio, it's fine. So that's how I, and then NPR, of course, at this time, mid-70s, was coming into its own, and it was the place to be. And I went to American University, which has WAMU-FM, a 50,000-watt public radio station. And by the time I came back from 5 years in Vermont and New Hampshire, working in commercial radio there, public radio hadn't grown that much to be there. I had friends at WAMU. Morning edition had just begun. And so it was being in the right place at the right time, knowing people, having some experience, and I filled in the summer of May of 81 on morning edition, and by the fall they'd hired me as an associate producer on the show and a fill-in newscaster.
Did you study journalism in school?
Oh, I did, at American University, broadcast journalism.
Now, I would imagine...
That's where I made all those decisions.
Imagine that the field has changed, though. I mean, what you were taught... Let's talk about what you were taught in journalism, what you learned in journalism, and elements of that have really maybe turned on their ear, as it were, and then really have become very different in these 30 years.
Oh, that's a PhD thesis, but I think the fundamentals are the same: writing, good delivery, good news, journalistic tenets of journalism. Polices itself. There's no place where I go to get certified as a journalist and have that to hang on my wall. I get a degree in broadcast journalism, but oh, it's changed so much, John, I can't tell you. But I think that there are fundamentals that stay the same. A good investigative journalism, getting things from more than one source, making sure it's right, not rushing to air with bad information just because it's awfully tempting to. Things like that, I think, remain the same. But yeah, with the advent of social media and people picking up their phone to get the news each morning, it's changed incredibly.
You talk about not rushing to air with stories, which is really very counter to much of what commercial media and many forms of journalistic media pursue today, but that was really at the heart of NPR, was always a sense of going in depth, taking time to get it right rather than rushing to get it on the air. How would, and you were there pretty much at the beginning, how did that form? Was that the goal of the people who formed NPR in those early days?
Well, it was a conscious decision along the way, very early, to not worry so much about being first with information, but being concerned about getting it right. I think NPR's mission is simply to be, to inform and enlighten with information our listeners, and in any way we can, be it arts, news, science. So that's our mission in collaboration with member stations like WEKU. But yes, definitely along the way, a decision was made early on that we're not going to try to be that. We're not going to try to be the beat-the-buzzer journalistic outfit. We're the more thoughtful, stand back, put things in context, look at it. Now, I work for Newscast, which is concerned with timely information, and we have a strict set of principles we go by. We must have more than one source to confirmation, attribution, you know, our reporters. We listen to our reporters, those of us who are news anchors, who say, no, no, don't go with that yet. Let me check it out, that kind of thing.
And your role as a newscaster is not that of a reporter. You did not actually go out to events and stand there with a microphone and interview people and record sound of things happening. But you were in a position of collecting and organizing material to share within a five-minute newscast. Let's talk a little bit about that process. How did you make those decisions? And I know you're still doing that on call, even in the retirement that you have taken. But when you're in that newsroom, how do you decide what you're going to do at a minute past the top of the hour?
I'm a processor of news. It's a conduit. I read, I write, I deliver. I wash, rinse, repeat, and I do it seven times in the morning, 5 days a week. It's quite a grind. But the news changes, and I've internalized so much of that editorial judgment. It would take a while to tease it all out of me, but I'm reading the wires. I know what's important. I'm looking forward. It's a morning, so I'm looking forward. I'm going to tell you what happened late yesterday, but I'm looking forward to what's happening in the day. If there's anything that happened overnight, any bombs going off in the foreign world or whatever, determining what is news isn't really that hard. There's not a big mystery about it. At least I don't think so. And then you're mixing it up with the sound that my producer's given me, spots, actualities, that kind of thing. And it's a constant, you're really focused for that time once those newscasts start. Now I'm 5:30, 6:30, 7:30, 8:30, 9:30, 10:30, 11:30. All those news, and the news changes after, by 9:30, things are different. The domestic world is up and at 'em, and Congress is holding hearings, and things are happening around the country as opposed to the foreign world. So there's kind of that natural shift from foreign to domestic.
All right. Well, Jean Cochran has been our special guest for
Thank
this
you so
week's
much.
Eastern Standard, with an audience of 50 or 60 people at the Griffin Gate Marriott as the part of the WEKU Day Sponsor Reception. We're grateful, of course, to our listeners for your support of WEKU, and grateful to Jean Cochran for the work you've did for 33 years for NPR, and still you're still an ambassador for public radio.
Thank
Thanks
you
for being
so
with
much,
us.
John.
This is a special edition of Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations. In the next segment of our show, NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne. After that, we'll hear from science reporter Joe Palca. And before we're finished, we'll hear from Peter Sagal, the host of NPR's news quiz, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. We hope that you appreciate Eastern Standard being here every week on the WEKU stations. It's a public affairs presentation. It's an interactive program. We're unable to take your calls to interact with the guests this week, but we certainly encourage you to call and support Eastern Standard right now at 800-621-8890 or make your donation online, weku.org. FM. We'll be right back. In May of 2015, our guest was NPR political reporter Don Gagne. We invited him during an off year before the presidential campaign season began for the 2016 election. Don has 2 degrees from Michigan State University, one in telecommunications, namely radio and television, and another in advertising. We anticipated that the 2016 election would be interesting, and we knew that Don could give us some insights into NPR's political coverage, which he did. But today I want to share with you a couple of stories that he gave us, that he shared with us during his visit. The first of them, a lighthearted one about his encounter with the great Johnny Cash. Don was working early in his career as a country and western disc jockey at a small radio station in his hometown of Monroe, Michigan.
If people want to find audio of my encounter with Johnny Cash, I did a story about a year and a half ago on NPR about meeting him. So I'm working at this little country radio station, and I found out Johnny Cash was coming to the Monroe County Fair. And it was 1980 by then. It could have been 81. And this was not a great point in Johnny Cash's career or life, especially I read his biography and I kind of look back and I find out how rough it was to be a country legend and icon in 1980 as country music was changing and country radio was changing. Anyway, he came to the Monroe County Fair, and I tried to get an interview and tried to get an interview and tried to get an interview and couldn't get anybody to respond and couldn't work it out. So a guy at the fair kind of knew me and I think took pity on me, and he said, his bus is there, the stage is there, the grandstand is there. If you stand here, he's going to walk past. So maybe at the very least you can get him to record something for your station. You know, hi, I'm Johnny Cash. When I'm in Monroe, Michigan, I listen to WV. You know, I'm not even going to try to imitate Johnny Cash. So that was all I was hoping for, but I was prepared. I had a bunch of questions in my head. And sure enough, he came by, and I introduced myself, and he stopped and talked to me for 10 minutes. And I ran out of questions. And I asked him what I thought were like kind of really stupid questions, like, what's your favorite song you ever recorded? You know, and kind of stuff like that. And he was so nice. I asked him why he always dresses in black. And, you know, he's the man in black, right? So, 22-year-old kid, I said, why do you always dress in black? And Johnny Cash looked at me and he said, well, it's slimming. And then he actually gave a thoughtful, serious answer that's all in that song, which I recommend. Anyway, so I took that job as a country western disc jockey, and I got to know Johnny Cash. And because he was nice to me, and because he answered my questions, and because kind of my, you know, whatever ingenuity I had getting myself in that position paid off, that was a moment that I would look back on often as kind of, you know, it can work out. You can have really great things happen in this line of work.
During his visit with us in 2015, Don Gagne shared another story, this one about his involvement in coverage of the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks.
You know, it was like the nicest day ever. I mean, it was a September day, and it was just gorgeous. And I was at the White House already by then. I'd moved from Michigan to Washington in January of 2001 to cover the start of the Bush administration. So I was NPR's White House correspondent. On 9/11, Bush was in Florida. Everybody remembers those pictures of him reading to the kids at that elementary school in Florida. We'd already seen him give this education speech a couple of times, so we didn't go. Instead of waking up in Florida that day, I woke up at home, and I thought, this is great. I get to walk my daughters to school. You know, no hurry to get to work, because Bush isn't at the White House. The president's not at the White House. So I walked my daughters to school, the public elementary school, just a couple blocks from our house in D.C. And then I walked to the bus stop. So I was going to take, again, I was in no hurry. I was going to take the bus to the metro downtown to the White House. So I'm waiting for the bus, and my cell phone rings, and it's my editor, Ron Elving. And he says, listen, a plane apparently just hit the World Trade Center, and, you know, some kind of accident or whatever. He said, just when you get to the White House, just keep an eye on, you know, whether or not the White House reacts to it or says anything. You might have to get some reaction. So while I'm on the phone with him, the second plane hits. And, of course, I mean, I kind of get a weird feeling in the pit of my stomach just saying that right now, even, you know, almost 14 years later. But so I didn't wait for the bus. I ran the few blocks to Connecticut Avenue, caught a cab on Connecticut Avenue, took the cab down to the White House. I remember at one point on that ride, just kind of having this thought flash, I wonder if I'm going to a building that could be a target. But then you just don't think it anymore. Then you just kind of keep going. I mean, you got to get to the White House. And it's not going to be a target. Of course it's not, right? Except we now know it indeed may have been. So I get to the White House, and I'm going through security, and I hear somebody who's already through security, kind of where the TV stations all do their live shots with the White House in their background. I hear somebody over there yell at that moment, the Pentagon has been hit. At that point, there was a lockdown, and then people started pouring out of the White House. And I have these very vivid memories. You get to know the Secret Service guys really well. They're like, you know, they're like local cops. All of a sudden, they've got, you know, automatic weapons, and they're pushing everybody out. And the young women who worked in the West Wing were running up the driveway barefoot, carrying their heels so they could run faster. You know, and the place was just emptying out, all of us out onto Pennsylvania Avenue. I'll wrap it up kind of with what was the single strangest moment. I'm hearing all these sounds swirling around, you know, people rushing and people screaming, and there are, you know, helicopters up above and the Secret Service guys yelling at you. And I'm thinking, I got to get some of this sound for my story tonight. So I kneel down in the middle of the street and I get my gear out. To start recording, and when I look up, I'm surrounded by men and women in kind of white tunics and tall paper hats, like dozens of them. And, you know, I had this, in that instant, I thought, this whole day is just a weird dream. And it was like I was in a Monty Python sketch or something. You know, they were like, everybody was in white tunics with tall white paper hats. Okay, so that evening, there was a congressional picnic on the south lawn of the White House planned. And these were all the food prep people there, dressed in their, you know, the white chef's smocks and their hat. They all got evacuated out the exact same door. And eventually I got through to my wife, who knew nothing about what was happening because she didn't have the TV on or the radio. And I had one of those very difficult conversations. We may not talk today. And if you feel like you need to get on the road and run, don't wait for me to weigh in on that if you can't reach me. You know, I mean, you can't believe you're having that conversation. But you're having that conversation. And then finally I got through to Morning Edition, and they put me on the air with Bob Edwards. And I spent, you know, the next 4 hours on that corner off and on Morning Edition. So it was just, what a day. What an awful day.
NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne, our guest for the WEKU Day Sponsor reception and for Eastern Standard in May of 2015. Up next, NPR science reporter Joe Palca. And at the end of the program, Peter Sagal of NPR's news quiz, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, a program featuring people who bring us the news or have brought us the news on NPR, as well as someone who brings us a lighter take on the events of our world and our nation. We hope that you appreciate Eastern Standard being here every week on the WEKU stations, and we'll show your support during the Spring Fund Drive by calling with a donation right now. Our program is an interactive show, but we're unable to take any listener calls during this program, but we're still glad to hear from you when you call 800-621-8890. Give us your comments about the program as well as your donation for Eastern Standard or any of the other programming at WEKU. Stay with us. Our special edition of Eastern Standard continues on the WEKU stations, weku.fm. Joe Palca is very well-known and recognizable science correspondent for NPR. He's been there since 1992. We've heard his stories on the air and his online series, Joe's Big Idea, over recent years. Over recent years, we've become familiar with Joe's on-air and online series, Joe's Big Idea. Joe received a PhD in psychology from the University of California at Santa Cruz, where he worked on human sleep physiology. Our 2016 program with Joe Palca took place at the Lyric Theater in Lexington. And during that broadcast, Joe responded to an audience question about global warming and how he responds to the deniers of global warming.
I have an easy answer to that, which I'll freely admit is a cop-out. And the easy answer is that I'm a science correspondent. And people say, well, what about the people who say climate change isn't happening or it's not noticeable? And I say, well, happily, I'm a science correspondent, and the people who are saying that are not scientists, so I typically don't talk to them. Now, that's the cop-out answer. The reality is that there is a controversy, I know. To me, and I say this quite honestly, I am not satisfied myself that scientists have done a very good job of articulating what is enough of a response by society. I mean, they say, we have to do something. Okay, I get that. But they you know, does that mean no internal combustion engines? Or does it mean some internal combustion engines? No international travel on aircraft or some? In other words, it's a societal question how much of a response you want to make, but it's also partly a scientific one of how much of a response is enough. I mean, maybe it's too late. Maybe we should just enjoy the time we have and not worry about it. I think those are difficult questions to answer, but so that's where I'm sympathetic to the people. I don't understand people who say it's not happening. I mean, that to me is just, you know, put your head in the sand. But the people who say, I'm not sure how big of a change it's going to be or how much we can prevent, or what I like is that nobody's saying we don't have to deal with it. I was asked to do the scientific stands of the presidential candidates in the McCain-Obama campaign, and so I called, I tried to find out what Sarah Palin's attitude was. Well, but you guys are, it's, well, so I called a bunch of scientists who were environment in the University of Alaska, and they said Sarah Palin was the first governor of Alaska to set up an emergency committee to deal with climate change effect on Alaska. What? Now, at least she wasn't saying it's not happening. She can still say, I don't know what's causing it. But there's a reality. The people who have to deal with the consequences of climate change, they're not arguing about it. The military isn't asking itself, should we, you know, change the way we build our ships or the fuel we use? They're not doing that. They've already moved on from that. So it seems that there's another set of people who haven't. I have one other thing that I think has happened. When I'm old enough to have been a reporter, when somebody would publish a science study about the link between smoking and cancer, and then we'd all trot off to the Tobacco Institute and get the other side. And I think the other side is going to go away. Because when the Attorney General in New York State filed suit against ExxonMobil saying, you haven't warned your shareholders about the possible consequences to your business of global climate change, ExxonMobil didn't say, oh, it's not happening. They said, oh yeah, we've been telling them since 2009 this is a major problem. And I think it's this. I think there's a parallel there. I think that the people who actually have to deal with this problem, they're going to have the same answer, was people want to drive their cars, what are we going to tell them? That's like the tobacco company said, everybody knows, they went from one day saying, we're not sure tobacco is bad to you, for the next day saying, it's a personal choice, you get to decide whether you want to use it, everybody knows it's bad for you. So the same thing is going to happen, I think. This is me. This is an opinion. And it's not NPR's opinion. I'm Joe Palca. But it does seem to me there's a parallel that at some point people are going to say, look, we have to decide. You know, people want to buy these big cars. Why is it up to us to tell them not to?
This is Eastern Standard. Joe Palca, NPR science correspondent, is our guest for the WEKU Day Sponsor event at the Lyric Theater in Lexington, Kentucky. And our next caller walking to the microphone is Richard. Hello, Richard.
Hello. I also work as a scientist, but I'm interested in public affairs, and Roz stole some of my thunder. My question is going to be about human-caused climate disruption. I do have a complaint with the way some people cover it, and it's probably the news side rather than the science side. This idea you just alluded to, that you know that we have to have a debate, we have to have a balanced discussion, and when you have a real scientific consensus, which I believe we have on there's a human role on climate disruption, they find one of the few scientists who disagree, it really confuses the public. Is there a way to help the public understand what is meant by a scientific consensus? And I'll also say, we're in a state where we have numerous politicians that are climate change deniers. It's a real issue here. And we have a public that's very confused. You guys do a great job.
Well, Richard, we should point out that, Joe, we're also in the state that is home to the life-size replica of Noah's Ark opening this summer.
I think we could go on and on about what the public understands about science in this state. I mean, we got a problem.
So there's a question. I've been thinking a lot about this because this question comes up all the time, and I got into journalism because I said public needs to understand about science so they can make informed decisions. And basically the idea was that it was the information deficit model, that if people had the information, they would make a different decision, right? And I'm not confident any longer that I don't have another model. There's not another, I'm not allowed to do it any other way. That the news media and my sense of being a professional is you say what the facts are. That doesn't mean going to both sides, and we can talk more about that. When there's 100 people saying one thing and one saying the other, you don't go to the one guy. I get that. But I'm not trying to persuade anybody. I'm trying to offer facts. And I'm not sure that offering facts is having the result that you would like it to have. So if everybody in the state of Kentucky listened to WEKU and heard it and understood it and appreciated it, would they all change their minds and come along to think the way you do? I don't think so. Because I think I don't understand this, I'm a psychologist, and that's why I'm glad I'm not a psychologist anymore by training. You know, I'm a psychologist. I don't understand. We all make decisions based on fears and assumptions and belief systems and what have you, but I don't understand why facts seem to trouble people. I don't have an answer for that, but I don't believe that there's anything that WEKU could do differently beyond what they're doing, which is presenting the straight information in as clear and compelling way as they can.
And that's a great place for us to break away from NPR science correspondent Joe Palca. He was our guest last year for the WEKU Day Sponsor reception at the Lyric Theater in Lexington. Coming up in our final segment of the program, a guy who has spent nearly 20 years making fun of the news on this special edition of Eastern Standard. I'm John Hingsbergen, encouraging you to let us know if you appreciate Eastern Standard and our news and information programming by calling 800-621-8890 or by making a donation online at weku.fm. We're interested in your comments about this show. Please let us know your suggestions for future topics, your reactions to anything that we do at WEKU, but especially your focus on Eastern Standard. When you call 800-621-8890, or when you visit weku.fm. Our special edition of the program continues in just a few moments. ¶¶ This is a special edition of Eastern Standard from the WEKU stations. I'm John Hingsbergen, and in this final segment of our program, Peter Sagal, the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, NPR's News Quiz. In December of 2011, Peter and his crew, including the original scorekeeper on the program, Carl Castle, were here in Richmond, Kentucky at the EKU Center for the Arts. During the year following the program in Richmond, I had an opportunity to talk with Peter Sagal, and we reminisced a bit about the program in Central Kentucky.
It was a vast surprise that not all of you were riding horses. I just imagined that all of you would arrive at the venue on beautiful thoroughbreds, wearing tight white pants, high black riding boots, and sort of have like long flowing manes of hair, like Elizabeth Taylor in National Velvet.
That's only a few of us, actually.
Yeah, no, it was like a 30% beautiful horsewoman ratio in the audience. The rest of you came in traps and carriages, which I thought was also nice.
Well, during your production of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me last year, there were numerous references to the area, as well as, of course, inclusion of the guest, jockey Chris McCarron.
Who was great.
What kind of research is done in advance of a show like this so you come in prepared and ready to relate to the audience here as well as the listening audience?
Well, basically, we like to make stuff up. It saves time and effort. So, for example, that's why we did that enormous lengthy riff on the vast dye factories that were used to dye the grass blue, thus giving... Now, we love... I mean, one of my favorite things about going on the road is actually getting to talk to people who are from places that I am not from and find out about things that I do not know anything about. And in fact, as a number of thoroughbred and horse racing magazines and blogs noted... when that show was broadcast, I obviously know nothing about thoroughbred racing or horse racing or basically anything with four legs. And they offer this as like a criticism, like, oh, well, Peter Sagal's interviewing this jockey and doesn't know what he's talking about. That's why I'm talking to him. My ignorance, which some people think I'm feigning for effect, is genuine. I enjoyed finding out that people like him actually ride on the horses. I didn't know that. I thought the horses were allowed to race and people just shouted directions. Again, fascinating to find out.
Well, how important is...
Turn left! Left again! Left some more! Turn left now! Sorry.
Here at Eastern Kentucky University, yes, in the Center for the Arts, we had about 2,100 people in the beautiful new auditorium on the campus. How important is that the audience participation and the reaction from the audience in the production of the show?
It's actually a funny and rather personal story in that my background is not, in fact, in radio. My background was primarily in the theater. And I've always been used to a live audience. So for the first few years of our show, when we were doing it, again, primarily only as a studio show without a live audience, I was always very distrustful and unhappy because they could tell me that people were listening to it, but how did I know they were enjoying it? Or how do I know they were paying attention? Or how do they know they just didn't have it on the background while they were watching TV or something else? And these thoughts haunted my sleep. It was terrible. And then we started doing the show in front of a live audience. And you know, this is the funny thing. If you say something amusing in front of a live person, they might, if you're good at it, make some noise indicating amusement. So you know you're doing a good job. And I find that having lots of those people in front of me with the potential of making that sort of quick, aspirated laughing actually incentivizes me to actually put some work in and try to be funny. We're huge hams. We're all of us like dolphins jumping for bits of herring. I mean, if you laugh at us, we'll do all kinds of tricks. So I think it's a huge having an audience there with us is particularly going on the road and having so many people show up is a huge part of what we do.
Well, Peter Sagal, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has been on the air almost 15 years. Big anniversary coming up.
Yeah, we're just about, we're almost a couple of days. We'll be 1 month away from our 15th anniversary.
What have you learned over the 15 years since the show launched?
I've learned that there are a surprising number of people out there, millions of them, in fact, who have the same sick, weird, juvenile sense of humor that I and my colleagues do, which is both comforting and shocking. I had expected better of all you people. And secondly, I've learned that, you know, I used to be, as I said, a playwright in the theater, and I used to, like, want to make people scared or angry or just in awe of my understanding of the truth of this life and its miseries. And it's actually better to make them happy for an hour, you know? I mean, given a choice between, you know, making them feel miserable about how terrible things actually are through my art and making them laugh with a couple of cheap fart jokes, I think in the end I've learned that the second is actually the more noble calling.
Since Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and NPR don't get direct financial support from listeners, how
yes.
important is it for listeners to donate to their local station, namely to WEKU?
Oh, yes. It's actually extremely important. And I know that I'm famous for making lots of jokes and being irreverent, but this is actually something I take very seriously because I've actually become, I went from being a listener of public radio who was annoyed at the pledge drives to being a participant in public radio and a member of my local station who is actually very, very committed to not only the station, but the way that stations raise money. Here's how it works. If listeners like what they're hearing, they can listen for as long as they want, and then they can and should donate to support it. It's like the exact opposite of the way the rest of the world works is you have to pay first and then maybe you get to enjoy something. And if you don't like it, you're out of luck. In public radio, you get to listen to it. You get to decide if it's worth your support. And if you're listening to it, if you're listening to me right now, then it must be some value to you. And then public radio stations very politely ask you to contribute something to recognize that value. And then that money goes directly to pay for what you hear. Because the money that your station collects and the other station collect from their listeners, they get paid in part to NPR, which pays me to continue to do the show. Because it's actually kind of expensive. We have to pay everybody, myself, all the writers, Carl. We have to pay our panelists. We have to fly to wherever we're going. We have to, you know, we have expenses that have to be paid in order to continue doing the show. And when you think about it, this is the fairest, most just way of financial support that's ever been invented. It's capitalism perfected. We let you enjoy it, and then we ask you to support it based on your enjoyment of it. And it's all great. And you know that the money that you contribute goes to create the thing that you know you already like. It's absolute. It's like the world's best guarantee. We know you'll like it because you already do.
Peter Sagal, what a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Peter Sagal, Joe Palca, Don Gagne, and Gene Cochran, just some of the voices of NPR who have visited our area on behalf of WEKU during the past few years. Stay with us for more information about this year's day sponsor event with another of the best-known voices of NPR, Cokie Roberts. Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Eastern Standard on the WEKU stations.